I should mention that this is the following people work on some aspect or all of what I'm going to talk about today. So Barry, who's omnipotent and works, is my supervisor, and Gilad Gore is also co-supervising me on this project. So I think this could go. Super. So I'll be talking about preferably two modifications to the Speckens toy model. So before that, I'll give you a reason why I even bother looking at toy models to begin with. I figured many of you, I don't know if all of you know the Speckens toy model, but I'm going to talk about it anyway. And I'll then tell you about two different relaxations that we've come up with to test how the toy model's axioms can be altered and capture a bit more of quantum behavior. So the background is, the idea of the epistemic view on quantum states, and this is by no means, don't take my word for it, but I trace it back to Zeilinger's foundational principle that basically says that the simplest system holds one bit of information. Then comes Caves, Fuchs, and Schack about the wave function representing subjective information about the system. Then one of the papers that really, really liked and impressed me is this one by Clifton, Bub, and Halvorsen, where they state three information theoretic constraints out of which they kind of derive quantum theory. And then there's Kirkpatrick's little neat game about quantumness in a deck of cards. I really recommend you play it. It's quite fun. And so the last one, which I'm going to talk extensively about, is Speckens' toy model, and which basically asserts that exact knowledge is incomplete knowledge. So the motivation that for the work is we were actually thinking of what really is quantum and how it's, if different classical principles, what kind of aspects of quantum theory can we actually capture? And in the process, we get to learn what is really quantum about quantum theory, and we then asked if we can extend Rob Speckens' toy model and capture more quantum phenomena in the process, and finally to basically see how robust his axioms are. And I'll explain what robust is in the process, hopefully. So the first thing is that Speckens' toy model has this information theoretic principle, which I call the knowledge balance principle, or KBP for short. It basically says that at any time, the amount of information you know about the system equals the amount of ignorance you have about the system. And first thing is, there's this thing called the ontic state. That's just the true state of the system. If I know this state, I can predict all possible outcomes. Then I have to quantify what information is. So the way Speckens does it is he says, well, there's a minimum set called the canonical set, and that's just the least number of questions I can ask that will fully determine the ontic state of the system. And then there's this thing called the epistemic state, which is just a state of knowledge. And from here on, this is how the toy model proceeds. The axiom zero is all systems obey the knowledge balance principle. And then the simplest toy system is described by this hidden parameter x. It can be in one of four possible states. I've labeled them here as boxes. And KVP dictates that X is known to be in a subset of two or four of these ontic states. So for example, if it's in a subset of two, if it's in one or four, I'm going to write this in this classical Ket notation, and it's just basically that four-dimensional vector. So next, so we need to know what kind of states arise from this axiom. There's six pure states, one mixed state. I denoted them here. This is the first kind of what I refer to as a box representation. You can also represent this thing on a tetrahedron. The edges are your states. The vertices are your, the edges are your epistemic states. The vertices are your ontic states. You can put them on a sphere. It's sort of an analog of the Bloch sphere. Here, you don't represent ontic states. You only represent epistemic states. And then finally, once you know how many states you have, you want to know how can you move from one state to the other. So the second axiom of the toy theory is, it says that a valid reversible transformation maps ontic states to ontic states reversibly. So in the representations I told you, it's just permutations. I either permute boxes, or if I write it in the linear representation, it's just a permutation matrix, or I rotate my sphere certain ways, or it's the symmetries of the tetrahedron. Next come measurements. How do I infer about the system? Well, it says that a valid measurement is a partition of your toy space into epistemic states. So for example, for a single toy bit, there's three partitions you can do. You can either ask if it's in 1, 2, or 3, 4, 1, 3, 2, 4, and so on. And then there's an additional parameter that says that after you've made a measurement and you've updated your state of knowledge, you have to update the state of the system to your outcome. So in other words, suppose I have this state, and I ask, is it in 1, 2, or 3, 4? Then with probability 1 half, I'm going to get 1, 2. If I do, I update to this state. If I get 3, 4, I update to that state. And finally, you have the requirement that elementary systems compose under the tensor product. Moreover, your knowledge balance principle applies to the composite as well as to each part. And what that means is that states, you have two flavors of states now. You have uncorrelated states and correlated states. You next have these kinds of these kinds of operations, and you can actually verify that the total number of operations you can do in the two toy bit case is 11,520. And your measurements are simply these gaps. They're, again, of two flavors. I can ask either uncorrelated measurements, or I can actually do two toy bit measurements where I ask correlated questions. And with all that, just those four axioms, this toy model can actually do quite a bit of quantum theory. So you have non-commutativity of measurement, no cloning, no broadcasting, teleportation, remote steering. But the most important bit is that you don't get violation of BM-Bell-CHSH, no Cohen-Sperker theorem, no qudits, and no continuous set of quantum states. So what we thought is, well, yes.
The statement of the knowledge balance principle, we're saying we only know half the information. Is there any type of reason?
Not as far as I know.
So it's just like the way we've defined the model is this.
Yeah. We'll define this principle and see what it does, basically. So we live in an epistemic universe. The way that the second axiom regarding operations works is it demands that you map ontic states to ontic states deterministically. But if you're in a toy universe and you're an empiricist, you don't see ontic states. All you see is operations mapping epistemic states to epistemic states. So the first relaxation we said, okay, so a valid reversible operation now is just a linear map, and that permutes the epistemic states themselves, and I don't care what happens to the ontic states. This means that whereas before I had operations that were just simply permutations, now I have these guys, and I'm allowed to have this kind of operation. That's correct. Yeah, precisely.
Okay.
I'm just saying,
this is to some extent, I mean, this is an aside, but it's to some extent like a remark that John Smolin made when Rob first introduced this. John said the object states play no role, so you really should give a many worlds interpretation to this.
I don't know about that. So, I mean, to me.
So you're not quite doing that, but
no.
You're playing the game where you just forget about object states now.
Exactly. I'm just saying, I don't know, I'm not allowed to know the ontic states to begin with, so I'm not gonna care about mapping them deterministically. I'm gonna allow a non-deterministic match on ontic states as well. That's all we're doing. And if I do that, it basically becomes the fact that, I mean, if the operations I just showed you, the permutation one is this one, now I'm allowed to do things like this on the toy sphere, which I wasn't allowed to do before. And then,
could you let us stare at that transparency a little longer? What's going on the right there?
So what's going on is this operation right here this one. What it does on the sphere is it maps this state to that state, this state to this state, and this one to that one, and takes this state to that state.
Oh, so you're not just allowing indeterministic transformations of the ontic states. You actually have your transformation matrix on the previous slide. It's not a stochastic matrix at all. It's got negative numbers.
Yeah. Okay. It's not.
So then, if you abandon the notion of an ontic state, then how can you underlying this?
No. I'm not abandoning the notion. I'm just saying the ontic states are there, but the knowledge balance principle does not allow me to know it. So therefore, demanding that my operations map ontic states to ontic states is too restrictive.
But I mean, these new transformations that occur, do they have a maybe cashed out in terms of some transformation on the ontic states, or is it just not even? You don't have stochastic matrices, it becomes just some kind of.
Yeah.
So they're not even epistemic states anymore, because they're not states of knowledge about something, they're just states.
No, it maps epistemic states to epistemic states.
What makes them epistemic?
The fact that the epistemic part comes from the fact that I'm not allowed to know the exact ontic state.
But there's no longer an ontic state to be known. This is what I'm asking. Maybe I'm misunderstanding.
I was
wondering if you drop on the philosophical principles. Motivates the model when you do this, or maybe you don't.
No, I don't. No,
you don't think so?
No, I don't think at all.
We're sort of in Fuchs' world here, right? If there's still knowledge, we just don't know what their knowledge about. Or am I abusing?
No, I don't think we're in Fuchs' world. It's an ugly place. You wouldn't want to be
there. The situation is that
it does seem difficult to keep the terminology epistemic versus ontic if you're going to imagine that you have these transformations on the epistemic states, and it's completely disconnected from what's happening to the ontic states.
Yeah.
Well, actually, these epistemic transformations presumably can be thought of. I mean, each epistemic transformation you've got presumably can be mapped to transformations on the ontic states.
No, this map.
But just not uniquely.
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, exactly.
So there should be many different ontic transformations that could correspond to that map.
Yeah. Sure.
So can you not just say, just think of the set of ontic transformations, or set of equivalence clusters of ontic transformations that map to these, or do? Here's my question, I guess. That transformation you have on the right.
Yes.
In epistemic terms, will map to. That's one epistemic transformation, which we can map to a number of different ontic transformations.
Sure.
But what happens when I'm coming the other way?
I don't believe that.
John, yeah, if you're right, I'm really confused. I don't believe what you're saying, let's put it that way.
Okay. So I guess the clarification is this. If I were to actually see, suppose I multiply this matrix by the vector 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, which is just an ontic state, then what I'll get out is jargon. Just some of them again. Just nonsense. Right. Yeah, because I'm going to get 1, 1, 1 points.
So you get a non-positive quote probability distribution unquote over the ontic
state. That is correct. So I have a deterministic ontic. I mean, I start with a state that is in ontic state 1. I apply this transformation, and now I don't know. Like now, the ontic state is everywhere and nowhere.
So it's like a negative valued quasi probability representation. Oh, no, it's like a negative ontic state, isn't it?
I hesitate to call it anything else other than just a map that maps epistemic states to epistemic states. That's the only thing that I care about.
Okay, this is Sean. So normally you would think of an epistemic state as a probability distribution over the ontic states,
mm-hmm.
right? And then, of course, if you have transformations of the ontic states, that will induce transformations on epistemic states as
correct.
Well.
So now what I'm doing is I'm allowing those, but I'm also allowing for the fact that I have transformations that don't deterministically map ontic states to ontic states, but still take valid epistemic states to valid epistemic states.
But then so this is not, I mean, if you have so something like this, if you take a probability distribution of the ontic states,
yes.
you get a new valid distribution. But if you would apply that for an individual, which is not a valid epistemic state,
correct,
then you get bullshit. Then,
yes, right.
But then this is not ontological model, because it has to apply to the individual ontic states as well.
I think perhaps you might be able to recover an ontological model if you assumed that these more general transformations could be described ontologically if you include the ontic state in your measurement apparatus, possibly even the observer.
Sure.
There's some larger, I mean, or is there some reason you can't even do that? Because I'm not getting.
I haven't looked at that. I mean, it wasn't really, I mean, to me, it's this, if you're in an epistemic universe, I see no reason why you're not allowed to map an epistemic state to an epistemic state.
Maybe there's a confusion is that you're using the word epistemic, and really you should be using to describe the state you're talking about. Really you should be using the word maybe instrumental, because epistemic implies an ontic model. Because epistemic is, whereas what I'm really saying is, these are the things I can access. So they're sort of the instrumental states.
Yeah.
And you're not worrying about whether there's an ontic model underlying it.
Yes, exactly.
So why, I don't understand what constraint is disallowing you from, if it's an instrumental state, then why don't we just have quantum mechanics? I mean, you could generalize a set of transformations to be all quantum mechanical instrumental transformations, but so you're considering something that's not quite all quantum mechanics.
Yes.
So what is the principle you're appealing to find this subset of transformations that's greater than the set of ontic transformations, but less than the set of quantum mechanical transformations?
I know the knowledge balance principle. I don't think anything.
So it's just preserving the knowledge balance principle.
Yes. So, so we did that. So, if I actually do, if you allow me to actually do that, that losing that constraint, then I guess the number, then there's a the maps that I'm allowed to do is just basically the number of ways of mapping these six states themselves. And that's very simple to do. I can get this right. So there's three axes, six ways of permuting the axes, and two ways to permute each, the two states on each axis. So there's, I now get 48 transformations as opposed to just 24 that was in Spackinson's toy model. And then if I go to two toy bits, we can run into a bit of a problem, because if the permutation is in S4, then if I tensor to the identity, that still makes a valid operation. But if I have an operation that's in my new group and not in S4, so if I have an operation that's that matrix with ones and minus ones, and I tensor it with the identity, and I apply that map to these states, then I get jargon coming out the other end. But so because I want to stick to this axiom, I want to say that all valid reversible operations must map valid epistemic states to valid epistemic states. I'm not going to include these guys in my group of operations. And if I only include the operations that do the right thing, then what I get is a group of two-toy bit operations that's 23,040, so twice Spackinson's group. So before I tell you why I'm interested in this, and see Marcus has already moved up, I'm going to talk to you about the Pauli group and the Clifford group. So the Pauli group is just a group generated by these guys, and the Clifford group are basically all the rotations. Yes.
Slow you down again, but so it seemed like what you were saying in the previous slide was basically about an analog of complete positivity. That there are these operations. In fact, I think one of your operations is like the universal knot on a.
I will get to that. Right. It's
okay.
Just,
so my question then is, what you've done is you've thrown out the single qubit, the single toy bit operations that are not completely positive.
Correct.
But now you still have a larger group on two toy bits.
Yes.
Aren't some of those going to be not completely positive in the sense that when you would act on four toy bits, they would lead to
that? I don't know. The problem is with actually checking these operations for more than two bits is that it's not very clear what constitutes a valid state, even at three bits, at three toy bits, and so on and so forth. So that's actually something that would be an interesting thing to find out. So, So yeah, the Clifford group is just all the rotations that map the Pauli group to itself under conjugation. And then what I'm going to call the projective Clifford group is I'm making all operations that differ by an overall phase to be equivalent. And then the extended Clifford group, I'm going to allow reflections and rotations that map the Pauli group to itself. And again, I'm going to project down, and I'm going to say that all operations that differ by an overall phase are equivalent. And if I do that, then this group, the Clifford group for one toy bit modulo phases, is a group of order 24. And it's basically just the symmetry group of the octahedron under rotations. It's isomorphic to S4. And then the extended Clifford group for one toy bit is just the full symmetry group of the octahedron, rotations and reflections. And it turns out that that is also isomorphic to my new group, this VG1. So everything's nice. We're getting somewhere. And then I've got two toy bits. And the Clifford group for two toy bits is that order, exactly the same as Spekins' group, but it is not isomorphic to it, because the Spekins toy group contains a subgroup of order 720. The projective Clifford group does not. But this group is 23,040 operations. And it is actually isomorphic to our TG2. And you can verify that if you want to have the code. I run it on GAP. And it tells me they're isomorphic. So I believe it. Yes?
Can you remind me what reflection would be in this picture? Just a reflection on any plane?
The reflection, oh, in the two-toy bit case?
Well, in the previous graph there.
Oh, yeah. So a reflection would be, take a plane. For example, take a slice here, reflect.
Is that going to be unitary or anti-unitary?
It's anti-unitary.
It's anti-unitary. Yes. So you're allowing anti-unitary. So you have something greater than quantum mechanics then. I mean, something that isn't a subset of quantum mechanics.
Sure, yeah. But the idea is that if this group is isomorphic to the extended Clifford group, then there is some subgroup of this that's isomorphic to the Clifford group. So now we get to your point. So we have these operations that you cannot tensor product with the identity. And they obviously pose a problem, because if you have if this is to be a physical theory, then if an operation is valid on one toy bit and I have an ancilla, then it should also be valid on two toy bits. So the way to describe this is, if say, well, it's a positive map is a map that's, if it takes a density matrix to a valid density matrix, and it's completely positive if I add to that density matrix an ancilla, and I act the operation on my density matrix, I still get a positive map. And a slight preamble is that, remember that an operator is separable if I can write it in this form. And there's a famous criterion. Sorry?
This is a niggling point, but for completely positive, we need to consider the action of delta tensor I on all kinds of states, not just.
Oh, yeah, sorry. There should be a bracket there. I'm sorry.
No. You need to consider entangled states.
Particularly, you have to consider entangled states.
Oh, okay.
So that definition is actually equivalent to positive. It's only if you act on an entangled state that you get a different definition for positive and complete.
That's true. Yeah, that's exactly your Hordijk criterion.
Yeah, okay. I took this definition. But everything still works. So, yeah.
Well, then you didn't have completely positive. That's not the definition of completely positive.
Okay. So it has to be tensor and entangled state.
Well, you don't want
to tensor. No, it's just entangled.
You have the tensor I acting on an entangled state.
Okay. Right, okay, fair. Yeah, so, the Hordijk criterion says that, if you have a density matrix, rho is separable if and only if this condition is true. And I can actually recast all that in the toy model sense. And instead of positive, I'm going to talk about validity-preserving maps. So a validity-preserving map is a transformation that maps valid epistemic states to valid epistemic states. I'm going to say completely validity-preserving map is one that if I tensor the identity and act on two toy bits, it takes a valid epistemic state to a valid epistemic state. And I can form this thing called the correlation test, which is basically the Horodecki criterion just in the toy model. It says, let sigma be any two toy-bit epistemic state. Then it's separable if and only if, sorry, it's maximally correlated if and only if there exists a map that gives me, that takes that sigma into an invalid two toy-bit state. And here's a quick proof of how you do it. So I have this state, and omega is my map with ones and minus ones, then this is invalid. But if I have any state of this form, which is that, and I act on it with omega plus I, I get a valid state.
What's omega being drawn from?
From TG, from the whole thing, including I tensor H.
So it's being drawn from validity preserving maps, but not necessarily completely validity preserving maps, right?
No, it is drawn from maps that are completely validity preserving and validity preserving.
But if the map is completely validity preserving.
No, hold on a second. Say it again. So it's drawn from validity preserving, but not completely validity preserving. Yeah, so, yeah.
Okay. So.
Okay.
Sorry, I'm a little. What's confusing me is that the word maximally correlated seems to be kind of the same as entangled. And the Horodecki criterion said the state is separable if it doesn't lead to a contradiction when you act on it with a positive map.
No, I just said I just switched both arguments around, that it's maximally correlated if it returns an invalid.
I guess what's worth
that's much stronger than
that, so those aren't equivalent, right? I mean, there are states that are not maximally entangled that nonetheless have a negative partial transpose.
In the context of the toy model, that may not be the case.
Yeah. Well, again, so that's what I'm trying to figure out. Is it that there's no states that are sort of almost maximally correlated but not quite?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
So just to wrap up, this is the end of the first kind of relaxation. So spec inside 24 operations, if we allow for mapping of epistemic to epistemic states, you get 48 operations. Then we have that S4 is isomorphic to the one toy Clipper group modulo phases. And our single toy B group is also isomorphic to the extended Clipper group. Then we have this, the first alterations here, that the Speckens toy group for two toy bits is not isomorphic to the Clifford group. Ours is isomorphic to the extended Clifford group. But we have that all the operations in Speckens' group are completely positive, and the operations in our group are not completely positive. So that's the first relaxation. So now I'd like to talk about a second relaxation that we investigated. And this one is actually altering the axiom regarding valid states. So remember, the first axiom of the toy model was that you have this one parameter, and it's constrained by the knowledge balance principle. So what we're saying now is that there's actually two parameters. One parameter is constrained by the knowledge balance principle, x. And this other parameter, y, is completely indeterminate and cannot be determined by any measurement you do. Okay, So what was basically one row of boxes is now two rows of boxes. And what we're really saying is that when Speckens writes this state, he really means this state.
Quantum mechanics is that whenever you perform a measurement, there's a hidden value that you don't see.
I'm not aware of that, but I don't know. Is it?
It's got that flavor.
It's got the flavor. I wonder to what extent it's.
I'm not aware of that work. So.
His isn't a toy model, it's an attempt to reconstruct quantum mechanics. But it's of the same sort of flavor that when you perform a measurement and you get one outcome, what it really signifies is that there were two possible ones, and you just don't know which.
It's going to be actually exactly the same thing. So what we're saying is, okay, this parameter cannot be determined at all. If it's actually a true parameter, then some aspect of it must manifest itself during measurement. And what we're saying is the following, is that if you give me this state, I know for sure that it's not a combination of this and that, because these two states violate the knowledge balance principle. So it must be a combination of either this thing or this thing. So the crucial bit is this, is that I actually know that the state is this. And I do not know whether this state came about because you prepared it as a mixture of this and this, or because you prepared it as a mixture of this and that. So I'm allowed to ask an extra question now. And my question is that a pure state in X, that is a state that only has two X labels, can be prepared in one of two possible ways. And we can know how the state was prepared by simply asking this question. Is y for x equals I the same as y for x equals j or not? So in this case, if you really prepared it this way, then I'll get the answer no. And if you prepared it this way, I'll get the answer yes. It's very reminiscent to what's in hidden entanglement, where you give me a completely mixed state. And then if you actually tell me that you prepared this state using this set or that set, if you let me know one classical bit, then I can know which one I have. It's exactly the same concept. So I ask an additional question, and I find out which way you prepared this mixture. So now I'm going to represent this state as 1100, and every time you see a colored box in the bottom row, I'm going to add a minus one to it to distinguish it, or similarly, likewise, a bar over two. And so I should mention that you get 12 states of this type. There's six in Rob's model. Each state can be of two types, either both up or one up and one down. And you get eight states of this type. So you get a total of 20 single 20-bit states, as opposed to just six that Rob had. Next, I want to declare what a valid operation is. So now I'm saying a valid operation is anything that permutes the symbols of x or the symbols of y or both. So in this case, it's operations that permute just x is this guy, and this guy permutes both x and y. I don't think it would be too much to ask you guys to actually remember this, because they're going to appear again later. The crucial bit about this is that I can get these two operations to anticommute. And I can verify that the group of single 20-bit operations is of order 384, as opposed to 24. And moreover, is if I have two states that are equivalent, i.e. they are up, down, or down, up, then they get mapped to equivalent states. So my third axiom is about measurement. So now I have an additional parameter, so I need to count for that. So what we're saying is a reproducible measurement is comprised of two questions. I ask about x, and then I ask about y. So I ask, for example, is x in 1, 3, or 2, 4? I get an answer. Depending on that answer, then I ask, is y for x1 or x2 the same as y for x3 or x4? If you think about it, what I'm effectively doing, yes?
We started by saying that y was utterly and completely inaccessible to any measurement.
So directly, yes. So I can't ask what is y for x equals 3.
So how, I mean, if it's inaccessible to measurement, why can I ask questions about it at all? I mean, if it's inaccessible to measurement, it's also inaccessible to preparation, so.
No, so what we're saying is it's, you cannot ask questions about y directly. You can infer about y indirectly. So this question never tells you what y is.
Okay, but that requires that it's possible to prepare. I mean, in order for there to be any correlation between x and y, if I can't measure it directly, right? So if I can ask indirectly, mm-hmm. there must be correlation between x and y. And that means that I must be able to prepare states. You just have some control over why in the preparation. Whoever prepared these.
Yeah, things. You do. I mean, when you do this business, that's precisely what you're doing. Right? I mean, so what you're asking is my preparation made of this or that? You can never actually know if you have this state or that state. But you can know that the state you're given was prepared from one of these two.
So I need to assume that somewhere out there in the universe, there's somebody who has the ability to prepare, to, you know, to reach in there and twiddle why, even though I can't possibly observe it.
Sure.
All right.
Okay, can I maybe just ask Watkins' question in a slightly different way? Which is, suppose I was an experimenter in toy world,
mm-hmm.
and I just didn't know about this hidden Y bit, even though the hidden Y bit was rare.
Yes.
And I performed my ordinary X measurements,
mm-hmm.
and my measurement apparatus automatically performed the necessary Y operation afterwards. I just never noticed.
Okay.
Would I ever be surprised by the results I get, or would the results be just the same as if the Y bit didn't exist?
You would be surprised.
I would be.
Yes. Okay. I'll tell you in a little bit.
Let me belabor this point here. So in Rob's original model, if our here are the four object states.
Yes.
If my epistemic state were these two,
mm-hmm.
and now I measure this versus that, and I got this,
uh-huh.
then here's my initial epistemic state.
Yes.
Then I get this outcome.
Uh-huh.
I'm able to immediately infer that the state was this one.
Correct.
But then he has an extra randomization because we're not allowed to know that much. So he allows inferences down to a more precise state than we can know immediately after the inference is made. Is this point of the same flavor?
No. If you run that argument in this point model, you will discover that you can never know. So if you say the x is 1, then you would be, well, it's either here or it's there. So you can't do this. You can never
retro whatever the word is.
No, you cannot. You cannot retro get the
answer
ever. It will never work. That's what we're saying. So. So it's just to return to this point is if you actually think about the questions that you're asking, what you're effectively doing is you're asking the question. This question corresponds to you forming a basis in four-dimensional real space made of these vectors, which are precisely the eigenstates, the eigenbasis, sorry, of this operator. So I can actually rephrase my axiom about measurements in terms of operators. I'm saying the reproducible measurement is represented by a self-adjoint operator, and after the measurement, the state of the system is updated to whatever outcome I get. And finally, you also require that simple systems compose under the tensor product, and you also require that the knowledge balance principle applies on X, and the indeterminacy of Y applies to the whole, as well as to each of the parts. So what this gives rise to is states of two flavors. You can either have uncorrelated states in X or correlated states in X. And you can actually very easily infer that these kinds of states can have either no minus signs or two minus signs. These kinds of states can have what, 0, 1, or 2 minus signs. And you get a total number of 386 that's pure states in X. I haven't considered mixed states in X. But the striking thing is actually the amount of number of operations you can get in two toilets. So you have two types of operations now. You have just simple tensor products of your single toilet operations. And you also have 16 by 16 walking matrices that have plus and minus signs on different places. And you can verify that the group of operations you get is monstrous. It's 23,590 operations.
So what's your goal? Is it to get monstrous groups of operations?
No. I was actually, I disliked the number. The goal is to actually get contextuality. and I'll show you how to get it.
Goal is to get conviction.
Yes.
Which is that related to the number of operations?
No. It's just related to the favorable operations. So just to wrap up, the measurements are, again, separate joint operators whose eigenvectors span the entire two-unit space. And here's how we get contextuality. So first of all, I'll let you know the Mermin Paris array. I've heard this being called the magic square array. I've heard it being called the Mermin array, the Paris array. So I decided to call it the Mermin Paris array. So the contextuality here is simple. If you notice, in every row or every column, the operators commute, that each of the nine operators has eigenvalues of plus or minus one. And for any given row or column, any operator is the product of the other two, except in this column here, where you have the minus sign. And I'm going to rewrite the whole of this array with just the operators I showed you. So if I write it this way, I get exactly the same relationship. They commute in each row and column. They have eigenvalues plus and minus one. And every operator is a multiplication of the other two except these guys here. So just to wrap up the second relaxation, is we have that. So instead of all the variables governed by the knowledge balance principle, we say that only some variables are affected by it, and there are other variables that are completely indeterminate. And if we assume that, we get all these nice extended states and operations. But most importantly, we get the Cohen Sprecher, but no Bell CHSH. We still don't violate the Bell CHSH inequality. So in summary, yes?
All locality is just one version of contextuality. How come you get contextuality?
So if you violate the Bell inequality, it is true that you are having a contextual model. If you demonstrate the Cohen-Sprecher theorem, at least in four dimensions, that doesn't guarantee that you will violate the So yeah, so the first model is a relaxation of valid operations from ontic to epistemic determinism. You can scrap that out and add the flavor that we discussed here if you want. So remember that we established that a two toroidal group was isomorphic to the extended Clifford group modulo phases, but the model is physically unreasonable because we allow for not completely validly preserving maps. And we showed that that you can form some form of correlation test in STM using the maps that aren't allowed and don't map valid epistemic states to valid epistemic states. And the second thing we did is we relaxed state and measurements by having an additional parameter that's always indeterminate. And that addition gave rise to the Cohen-Sprecher property for four dimensions. So before you ask your questions, I'd like to ask a few questions of my own. So the first thing that I don't know about is how to generalize the knowledge balance principle to allow for q-dits, or indeed for a continuous set of states. And there's very little known about the Sprecher toy modeling, say, three toy bits or more. And the other thing that I don't know about is whether or not there are tasks in this model that we can do that are not possible in STM at all. So that's that. And I should mention that what is to appear in the journal Math Phys is only about the first relaxation. I am working very, very hard to get the second one online as well. Thank you.
What does the C stand for in CPM?
Contextual tournament. Sorry, it's very inspired. Yes.
So there were two relaxations. Actually, can you flip back to your summary or conclusions? Right. So first we relaxed the valid operations.
Yes.
And then we did the relaxation of states and measurements.
Yes.
Are both of those necessary to get contextuality?
No, just a second. I didn't relax operations. I mean, I relaxed them in the sense that I had to account for the second parameter, but I didn't relax in the sense that I said, I'm going to map epistemic states to epistemic states.
So, my question is, where did we get contextuality from?
That's a good question.
Basically, hidden variable models don't exhibit contextuality.
The answer is that this is not a hidden variable model, precisely for the reason that Chris pointed out, that if I do this retro dip of going, oh, it was in 1.3, and now I get 1.2, so it must have been in 1, you can no longer infer that anymore. You have no knowledge. The reason we added y was precisely so that you can never know the true state of the system. And the contextuality comes about because you're basically allowing, so you basically have knowledge now about not just where the variable is, so you have your x variable, and now you also have an additional knowledge that says that this state that you hold was prepared out of one of two possible sets of states. And those were with whether the y's were the same or whether the y's were different. And the contextuality purely comes because of that. Because you're allowed to know how your incomplete knowledge was prepared.
So suppose that I take this state, which has these, I'm going to do the finger thing like Chris, these four blocks, right? Mm-hmm. And I say, well, I'm allowed to ask the question, basically, were x and y the same or different?
Mm-hmm.
Which tells me that either it was prepared as this,
right.
what you get.
It basically,
why can't I then do another measurement after I've done that, which allows me to retrodict?
I mean, you can add that, but I mean, what we discovered is that won't. If you know more than that, then you won't get the test shot. You need to have this ignorance. We've tried very, very hard. I mean, the initial concept was to actually add y in a way that was always fully determinable, and it just failed. I tried my utmost best. It still failed.
It's just very odd that somehow the ability to violate this, you know, to show contextuality, which is, a strong thing, depends on my ignorance.
It's kind of strange because it depends actually on part your knowledge about how this completely mixed y state was prepared, how it was given to you. It's just that you cannot know so remember you have a set with the two equivalent states, you can never know whether it's one or the other, but you know for sure that it's one of those two and not anything else. I think it's a beautiful idea. That you can only know all that and not more.
Okay. So excellent. How this with the Bohm model, because the Bohm model is a hidden variable model which also exhibits contextuality in the sense that it reduces quantity. Because maybe there's some analogy between the features your model has and the Poisson model.
I haven't compared it to anything else simply because, I mean, this was literally finished last Thursday.
Mm.
So
it is, because in the first relaxation, you went from having an ontic model to not having an ontic model because you heard about the states.
Mm-hmm.
But the second relaxation, you still have an ontic model, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So the claim is then that you have a hidden variable model with three features, which is contextual. So there may be a productive comparison with
the point. I hesitate calling it a hidden variable model because to me a hidden variable model must possess this property that Chris described, which is I should be able to say even after measurement where the actual ontic state was. And we're still going to allow that even in CPM.
It seems like you're reluctant to calling a contextual hidden variable model a hidden variable model.
Yeah, Bohm's theory is not defined as a hidden variable model.
Okay.
So
it's a prediction and non-contextuality the same thing. That's what
it's
That's just me. I don't like calling it that, but if contextual hidden variable model implies this.
And one thing that he might be related to is, I don't know this is true, but in the original spectroscopy model, the sort of dimension, if you like, of your state space, of your instrumental or epistemic state space, is the same as the dimension of your ontic state space.
Yes.
You need four properties to specify the four
yes.
states, and you're not losing. Whereas if you now increase the number of hidden states, you have eight. And suddenly you have more ontic state space than you kind of directly than you have in the instrumental
yes.
set of things. And so that might be related to contextuality, the possibility of contextuality.
Well, perhaps. I don't know how increasing the state space how affects any of the results. I mean, my original guess was that you really wanted, the contextuality in the pairs okay, really relies on you having the operators as commute rather than anything else. So.
Yeah. In your first relaxation,
mm-hmm.
Are there any of the new operations you're adding to the model? Operations that are physically reasonable, or are they all of this physically unreasonable?
all the operations I added fail to compose under the tensor part. I mean, you still like you remember I called it root z. You can have this. This is okay.
Yeah.
But you can't have this in any permutation. It is.
Any other questions? Let's thank Michael. Be around Sunday sitting in which office?
451.
451.
One. Bishop Key.
And probably lonely while he's here. So.